Good to go.
You know you slept well when somebody asks you how you rested and you say, I don't remember. That's about the way it was for me last night. I just don't remember much about it at all. But that's a good thing. Glad you're here this morning. Hope you slept well. And we remember those of our number who aren't with us, having surgery and those kinds of things. And so we'll certainly keep them in prayer. Turn to the 139th Psalm. I tend to revert back whenever I teach a class, a one-time deal, or sometimes even be in a place in the morning lessons every day. Sometimes I just go and revert back to the Psalms. Because there's some things in these Psalms that just speak to everyday life, connect with all of us, regardless of our age, regardless of where we are in life, regardless of what we're going through. They all have something to say to us that are very appropriate, very helpful, very applicable. And so I hope that'll be the case this morning. I've chosen the 139th Psalm because it's one of my favorites. And I really enjoy and appreciate what David says here. It makes me think, and I hope it'll make you think as well. I want to begin, though, by asking a couple of questions. How many of you have seen Old Faithful? Okay. How many of you have seen Niagara Falls? How many of you have seen the Grand Canyon? There's some things you see that once you see them, you never forget. And there are some things that you see that you can't really describe to somebody else what it is you saw. I mean, they just have to see it for themselves. One of my favorite stories is of a little boy who parents were taking him across country from the east to the west. And they bought him a journal. And they said, as we travel across the country, we're going to see all kinds of natural things and historical things. And you'll be able to write down in your journal the amazing things you see on our trip. And so they made their way across country. And every day they saw stuff. And little boy didn't write anything down. Nothing. Until they got to the Grand Canyon. And the little boy looked at the Grand Canyon. And I mean, he took off and he ran back to the car. And he got his journal. And I mean, he's just writing as fast as he could. And so the little boy went to bed that night. Well, you know what mom and dad did. Curiosity's killing them. And so they waited until he was asleep. And they snuck in there and they got the journal. And they brought it out and they opened it up. And this is what it said. It said, today I spitted a mile. He was impressed. And he's probably not the only one who's done that. There's some scenes you see that you just can't hardly put it into words. And different people react differently to different things. Some people react very outwardly. They're very emotional. Other people see something like that and they reflect on the inside. They get very quiet. Reflective. They don't say anything. The point is that regardless of how you react to these things that we see, of which we are in awe, the point is, regardless of how you react, you have to react. We cannot allow ourselves to become so calloused to our world that we don't even notice. We can't afford to lose our sense of amazement, to lose our sense of awe, to lose our touch of wonder at God's world. I'm always amazed when I watch little kids. Because by nature, kids are governed by the touch of wonder. A kid has to touch everything. A rock is not a rock to a kid. A rock is what goes in his pockets and he pulls out later and he says, look, Mom, look at this rock. But if it's not a rock, it's a leaf. And if it's not a leaf, it's a bug or a shell. You know, you give a kid a choice between a fistful of dandelions for his mama or a dozen store-bought roses, the kid's going to go for the dandelions every time. And what mama hadn't put those dandelions in a little vase up in the window in the kitchen? Problem is, we grow up out of that. We leave our childhood where everything is wonderful and everything amazes us, and we become adults, and we lose that sense of wonder. Now we have all kinds of explanations for everything, and assembly lines and interchangeable parts and computer screens and deadlines and demands and traffic jams. And first thing you know, it's like poof, gone is the childlike wonder of God's world, and we step into the adult sterilized version. And somebody reminds us and they say, you know, you need to stop and smell the roses. And it's like we don't even have time to do that. Well, David, as busy as David became as king, David never lost his touch of wonder. He never lost the awe of living in God's world. And in the 139th Psalm, what you have here is not some kind of lecture and as to theology. What you have here is the record of one man who stops long enough to think about God. And he writes down for us his thoughts. And in the 139th Psalm, David shares with us four wonders about God that he thought about and that all of us will think about if you just take time to think about it. The first one, in verses 1 through 6, he shares with us the wonder of God's knowledge. And David begins by describing the omniscience of God and that God knows everything. And as he thinks about it, he doesn't describe God's knowledge in some kind of abstract, philosophical, impersonal way. He thinks about God's knowledge in application to himself. Verse 1. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. He said, when I think about God, and when I think about all that God knows, I think about the fact that the God who made the universe, the God who created all of this, the God who controls the world, who rules the world, I am amazed that God, who did all of this, he knows me. And he cares about me. You know, Peter says in 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, cast all of your anxieties upon him because he cares for you. And that's what David is saying. I'm amazed the God who did all of this, he knows me. Which reminds me that the next time that you have a down day, or the next time that somebody puts you down, or the next time somebody can't even remember your name, doesn't matter, because David reminds us, wait a minute, the God of creation knows me, he knows who I am, and that's what counts. Now, beginning in verse 2, what does God know about me? David says in verse 1, I am amazed when I think about that God knows me. Well, what does God know about me? Well, David says God knows five things about me, verse 2. He says, you know when I sit down and when I rise up. David says, God knows what we do. The phrase sit down is passive. The phrase rise up is active. And so what he's saying is, God knows everything we do in the course of our daily life. That was a Hebrew phrase to describe the daily activities of life. Deuteronomy chapter 6, teach your children when they lie down and when they rise up. Throughout the course of the daily activities, said Moses, teach your kids about God. So David says the same thing. You know when I sit down and you know when I rise up through the course of my day. You know everything I'm doing. And then at the end of verse 2, he says, God knows what I think. He says, you understand my thought from afar. We can disguise our thoughts from people. You don't know what I'm thinking. I don't know what you're thinking unless we convey our thoughts to one another and communicate them and tell each other what we're thinking about. God knows what we're thinking. You can't disguise your thoughts from Him. So David says, you know, I think about the fact that God knows what I think about. Then in verse 3, he says, you scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all of my ways. He says, God not only knows what I do and God not only knows what I think, God knows everywhere I go, as indicated by my path. My path. That's more than just superficial acquaintance. David says, you are intimately acquainted, the New American Standard says. You are intimately acquainted with everything that I do, with all of my ways. Fourth, verse 4, you know what I say. Even before there's a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. God not only knows our words, God knows the motive behind our words. David says, even before I actually speak it, he says, you know it all. You know everything. And then in verse 5, you have enclosed me behind and before, and you have laid your hand upon me. God knows what we need. It's the idea of the hands of God protecting us, the hands of God providing for us, the hands of God pushing us along through life, the hands of God in His providence and in other ways. David is saying, look, God is there for us. Now, look at his reaction in verse 6. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain it. David says, you know, when I stop long enough to think about the omniscience of God, he said, the more I think about it, the more I just realize I can't comprehend all of this. My mind just can't go that far. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. Hold your finger there. Romans 11:33. Paul says something similar. Romans 11:33. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and unfathomable His ways. Paul says the same thing. Paul says, when I stop and think about God, and I think about God's omniscience and what God has done, he says, it's just unsearchable. It's unfathomable. I can't even begin to comprehend all of that. So David thinks about it. He takes the time to think about it. Secondly, he is caught up in the wonder of God's presence in verses 7 through 12. The wonder of God's presence. I think I put in your notes about the atheistic professor that wrote on the board, God is nowhere. And he came to class the next day and some insightful student had drawn a line after the W and now it said, God is now here. And that's what David is saying. God is now here because God is everywhere. You see in verses 1 through 6, he talks about the omniscience of God. Verses 7 through 12, he talks about the omnipresence of God. And he says, you know, I stop and think about, God isn't limited. We are limited by distance. We are limited by time. None of that limits God. And David says, it's hard for me to think about that. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? Now, David doesn't write that because he's wanting to get away from God. That's not what he's saying. He's saying this because he knew that he couldn't get away from God, even if he wanted to, which he doesn't. Where can I go from your spirit? Nowhere. Where can I flee from your presence? Nowhere. Is there any place where God isn't? Oh, several years ago, we had a a situation on a Sunday morning. I was not teaching a Bible class that particular quarter, and one of the teachers got sick at the last minute and called and said, I'm not going to be able to be there. Can somebody else take my class? And I was standing there when the call came in, and I said, I'll do it. I'll take it. Well, it was the little kids. It was the 4 and 5 year olds. And I thought, well, this is going to be fun, you know. So I was teaching the 4 and 5 year olds, and I just got down the floor and sat with them and taught those kids. I had a blast. And I was talking about this very point about God and how God is everywhere. Because I'm thinking, you know, the 4 and 5 year olds, there's some things that, you know, we can just kind of talk about some things they can kind of get. And I'm talking about, how, you know, the greatness of God and all that he's done. And God is everywhere. And I asked this question. It was a mistake. I asked the question, is there anywhere God isn't? And one little boy raises his hand. And I said, yes. Is there someplace God isn't? And he said, yes, God isn't in New Jersey. I said, why do you say that? He says, because we went there this summer and my dad called it a God-forsaken place. So, you got to be careful what questions you ask in 4 and 5 year old class. I assured him that God is in New Jersey. Now, all through Scripture, you find people testing this. You don't have to go very far in the book of Genesis. And God is walking in the cool of the day, and he's calling out the name of Adam and Eve. And where were they? Huh? Hiding on the trees. Playing hide and seek with God. How'd that work? Well, not very well. Ask Jonah. You get over to Jonah, same thing. Look in Jeremiah 23. Jeremiah 23, verse 23. Jeremiah 23, 23. Easy to remember. Am I a God who is near, declares the Lord, and not a God far off? Can a man hide himself in hiding places so I do not see him? Do I not fill the heavens and the earth, declares the Lord? And that's what David is saying. David is saying, you know, you can't run away from God. It's not going to happen. So he says in verse 8, Psalm 139 and verse 8, if I ascend up to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. So David presents some contrast. He goes from the heights of heaven to the depths of the earth. And he says, you are there. Verse 9, if I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest parts of the sea, the wings of the dawn, he may be saying, if somehow I could travel at the speed of light, I can't outrun God. If I'm in the bottom of the ocean, I can't escape from God. Now, some writers believe that when he talks about the wings of the dawn, he may be talking about the fact that the sun rises in the east. And when he talks about the sea, he may be talking about the Mediterranean Sea, which would have been to the west. And so what he might be saying is, when I think about the presence of God, I can go east, I can go west. It doesn't make any difference, because God is there. Verse 10, even there, your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. So he presents all of these contrasts, heights, depths, east, west, land, sea, doesn't make any difference. Verse 11, if I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, maybe I can hide in the dark. Maybe if I engage in things in the dark, God won't notice. And what does he say about that in verse 12? Well, even in the darkness, he says, it's not dark to you. And the night is as bright as day. Darkness and light are alike to you. Now that's frightening to the person living outside of the will of God. When you're living outside of the will of God and you realize that God sees everything you do and he knows everything you do, that can be a very frightening thing, because you realize there's no escape. But on the other hand, it is very comforting to the person who seeks relationship, to the person who seeks fellowship and friendship with God, to know that wherever I am, He is there. Jesus said in Matthew 28 and verse 20, when He sent those men out, He said, I am with you always. I am with you always. And God says in the book of Hebrews, I will never desert you. I will never leave you. Wherever you are, I will be there. Look in Isaiah 41, verse 10. Let me give you two or three verses to mark. Isaiah 41, 10. Isaiah 41, 10. Do not fear. Don't be afraid. Now, why is that important to us? Well, because we become afraid sometimes. He says, don't be afraid. Why not? For I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Now you talk about a verse to highlight and to mark and to remember. That's it. I tell you what I do. You know, on the front page of your Bible, you got blank pages. In my Bible, on one of my blank pages, I just write down, I know this is really complicated, I just write down verses I need to remember. You ever hear a verse, you come across somebody, Don's teaching or teaching a class, and you go, man, that's a great verse. And you don't mark it down, and then you forget where it is. You can't find it anymore. And so I just made a habit, I just mark down verses like this one in Isaiah, verses I need to remember, because I'll tell you why that's important. Some days you're just kind of blah. Some days are down, or some days you're just discouraged about whatever the case may be, or somebody disappoints you, or just you're just having a bad day. And I go to this page in my Bible right here, and I just pick one, and I just look and begin to read, and suddenly I come across a passage like Isaiah 41, and it's exactly what I need to hear. Or how about Acts 18? Acts 18 in verse 9 and 10. When Paul was in Corinth and it wasn't going well. Acts 18, 9. The Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, do not be afraid. Go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you. He said, Paul, you're not there by yourself. Yeah, there's been some opposition, but understand one thing. I am with you. Later he would write to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 16, 17, and he talked about some of the hard times in his life, and he said, you know, but the Lord stood with me, and he protected me. The Lord stood with me. And that's what I think David is wanting us to understand as he talks to us about the presence of God and the nearness of God. David said, when I think about God, I understand that He is with me all the time. The wonder of God's presence in our lives. All right, then in verses 13 through 16 of Psalm 139, he shifts gears a little bit. Now he starts talking about the wonder of God's power. He's talked about the wonder of God's omniscience and the wonder of God's omnipresence. And now God's omnipotence. David starts thinking about the power of God. Now, usually when a Bible writer talks about the power of God, he shifts over and starts talking about the creation. Psalm 19 and verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. Psalm 8, David himself stands out there on a star-filled night under the canopy of the heavens and says, what is man? As I stand here beneath all of this, what is man that you would take thought of him? Or Psalm 33, verse 6 and 9, he spoke, it was done, the creation. But he doesn't do that in the 139th Psalm. In the 139th Psalm, he says, okay, when I think about God's power, I think about the little bitty baby. I think about the power of birth. And that
puts it in another perspective. Because conception and the development of a child in the womb of a mother, and then the birth of that child, presents some wonders that a study of genetics and anatomy and obstetrics and all of that kind of thing cannot erase the power of God in the creation of something so small and yet so marvelous. And what David is saying in verses 13 through 16 is, if you stop long enough to think, how could you look at a little baby and not understand that God is the author of life? And David in these verses makes it very clear that God is personally involved with the development of each child. I had a young gal sit down and talk to me. She was pregnant, and she was struggling. Her and her husband had separated, and it wasn't going well. She'd made a decision to have an abortion, and I think she came to me thinking that I was going to just agree with all of her logic or whatever. I listened, and so she talked, and she talked about how bad her life was and how bad her marriage was, and it wasn't fair to bring this child into this relationship. It was all broken and all of that. And so she talked and talked and talked until finally she ran out of gas. And I just looked at her and I said, the only thing I can say is this. When God gives you a gift, you can't wad it up and throw it away. When God gives you the gift of a child, who are you to say, no, thank you. I don't want that. I don't care. You can't just throw that away. Well, she left, and several years later, I was preaching in a place, and I ran into her again. I had forgotten that she lived there, and she came up to me, and she said, I want to introduce you to my teenage daughter. Beautiful, beautiful young lady. And she and her husband had, through the grace of God, she and her husband got back together, worked it out. And that little girl was a gift. She was a very special gift. Listen, that's what David is saying. These are gifts. And when God gives you a gift, you better take care of it. God is the author of life. Look at verse 13. For you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. The emphasis is on you. Who's doing the forming? Who's doing the weaving? God is. Look in Jeremiah 1, verse 5. Jeremiah 1, 5. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, he said. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I have appointed you as a prophet to the nation. Look at this. He says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Who's doing the forming? Jeremiah says, God is. In Isaiah 49, in Isaiah 49 in verse 5, same thing. From now, says the Lord, who formed me from the womb to be his servant. Isaiah says, God had a hand in me. One more. Matthew 1 and verse 18. Matthew 1 and verse 18. Now the birth of Jesus was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child. Notice the child in the womb of Mary is not a blob of tissue. It's a child. It's a child. And what we learn by putting all of these verses together and what we learn from the 139th Psalm is that God has a hand in all of this. And here is the mind of a child intricately woven with the finest of neurological threads that fit together. Here's the emotions of a child cut out of a distinct texture. Here's a personality of a child made out of a one-of-a-kind pattern. So that when that child is born, there's nobody else like that child. We say no two snowflakes are alike. Big deal. No two children are alike. Think about your kids. They alike? Think about you and your siblings. Y'all alike? There's no two kids alike. I have one brother, and we're not anything alike. People see us and around us, and they go, I can't believe you guys are brothers. Well, we can't believe it either. You know, he is short. Okay. I'm not. He is bald. He says God doesn't put marble tops on cheap furniture. He is bald. He is smart. Now, you can go anywhere with that you want to. I don't care. But he is. My brother, I always laughed. When my brother brought home report cards, they were boring. They were always boring. A, 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 A. When I brought home a report card, it had variety. Let's just leave it there. It had variety. Because we're not alike in any way. We're so different. And I'm guessing it was the same way with you and your siblings. We're all different. How did we get to be so different? Same father, same mother. So how do we get to be so different? Well, David says, God, you did the forming. You did the weaving. There's your uniqueness. Verse 14, I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. There's no place where the power of God is seen with greater clarity than in the creation of life. And those people who feign disbelief in God need to come to terms, need to think about what David is thinks about. And that's the complexities of just the physical body. There's no computer that can do what the human mind can do for as long as it can do it. There's no camera that can see what the eye can see and capture and recall and remember. It's not by chance. David says in verse 15, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. My frame, my skeletal structure, my bones, skillfully wrought. I just put out beside there in my margin of my Bible, God's TLC. Because we were all skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. The depths of the earth is poetry. That's poetry for the womb of the mother. Verse 16, your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. Now, people get all hung up on this phrase, the days that were ordained for me. I don't think that he means a specific number of days for every person. I don't think that's what that means. I think what that means is God is the creator of life. God has ordained life. I think that's what that means. And because God ordains life, the days of life, man doesn't have a right to come along and play God and prescribe death. Verse 17, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. And then I love this last part. When I awake, I am still with you. I do that sometimes. You'll wake up and go, I'm still here. I'm still here. And if I'm still here, he's here with me. And we're going to get up. We're going to face another day. We're going to go through it together. Oh, he says, when I awake, I am still with you. Now, his reaction as he thinks about God's knowledge and God's presence and God's power, his reaction is just one of praise. One of praise. And it's not so much what David thought about God that stirred him, as much as the fact that God thought about him. How precious are your thoughts to me, oh God. The God who did all of this, the God who made me so unique, he thinks about me. He cares about me, loves me. Now, verses 19 through 22 seem odd. I don't know how else to say that. Seems out of place. Let's read it together and see if you don't think so. Suddenly David says in verse 19, "Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred, and they have become my enemies." Whoa! Where'd that come from? Well, as you come to the end of this song, David wonders about the judgment of God. But you have to understand something as you read these verses. You have to understand who David was. David was a theocratic king. He was appointed by God. He ruled for God. He was responsible to God. And I think there are some times in the Psalms where David speaks out of that responsibility. I think David speaks out of the consciousness of who he was as a theocratic king. So when you read verses 19 through 22, these are not the words of personal malice. These are not the words of personal vindictiveness. These are the words of a king who has a heavy responsibility, who is jealous for God. This isn't just David speaking for David. This is David speaking for God. So he's asking God to judge his enemies because his enemies were God's enemies. He's asking God he's confessing before God his concern for God's holy name and for God's holy people because he was the king. He had the responsibility. But you see the heart of David when you come to the end of the psalm in verse 23 and verse 24. After he says in these 19 through 22, judge these people. He comes back at the end of the psalm and he says, I'm asking you to judge me. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. And see if there be any hurtful way in me. And lead me in the everlasting way. Don't just judge these others. Judge me. Yes, David is grieved at the evil deeds of the wicked. But as you come to the end of the song, he wanted to make sure that his own life was not grievous to God. So he says, Lord, search me, try me, lead me. Now here's the point of the whole song. If we get caught up in the wonder of God, if we just take time enough to think about that, the knowledge of God and the presence of God and the power of God, then you don't have to be afraid of the judgment of God because you're walking with Him and you're in the kind of relationship with Him that David enjoyed. And you too can become a man or a woman after God's own heart. I love this song. It is just so simple. It's just the words of a man who took the time to think about God and write down his thoughts. And God has preserved it for us because I think his thoughts were some of the ones we have sometimes. Well, that's my lesson for the morning. I appreciate your attention today. I hope something was said that was helpful. Are we ending with a song? Is that what we're doing? And what was that number?
811.
Number 811. And so we'll end with this. You said 811? Okay. We'll end with this song this morning. If we can assist or help or encourage in any way, we certainly will. Let's all stand and sing this song together this morning.